And this is a national program. We're on all over the country. We're on three times on. Okay. We're on three times every weekend in New York City. So this will get lots, not just just a Minnesota program. Mm. Mm-hmm. We're not on in Kenya yet, but mm-hmm. maybe one day.
Maybe one day. So you don't have the equivalent of BBC's World Service?
Well, actually, there's something called NPR Worldwide, which uh-huh. is just getting going, which we are going to be on. Uh-huh. We're launching in Berlin in April. Mm. But I think that's just starting to roll, NPR Worldwide. So I think, you know, the BBC is unrivaled. I lived over there for a few years.
And did you? In
yeah.
England?
Yeah. I lived in Germany, and I listened to the BBC all the time in Germany.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's nothing like it.
Yeah. It's fantastic. And I guess they have the advantage of the colonies.
Yes.
And a lot of people still use English. Many of them use English as their, mm-hmm. as an official, either an official or national language. And for many, the BBC has represented the media that will tell you the things as they really are.
I know.
That's what they believe.
All
anyway.
Over the world. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it has that advantage. And mm-hmm. I always say, well, when they tell you the things as they are not, you'll never know.
<That's true. laughs>
Because we believe. You want to know the truth? Switch on the BBC.
I know. I remember I was talking to an American journalist once who was with the Khmer Rouge at the end of the Vietnam War, and he was out in the jungles, and they were listening to the BBC to know what was really happening in the war. That made an impression on
including me. Including their own countries.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
I feel it's so interesting to me that, I mean, I think, you know, that is a legacy of colonialism. Mm. But I'm quite impressed with what they've turned it into now.
No, they've been very smart
about it. And in the era of globalization, I feel like suddenly the BBC has a new reason
for being. No, they have really been very smart about it. As you know, immediately many of those colonies became independent. Mm-hmm. Whoever came up, I have never known quite, I'm not a historian, whoever came up with the idea that as they were becoming independent, before independence, all the colonies were known as the British Commonwealth. Mm-hmm. They were all part of the British Commonwealth. Mm-hmm. And then at independence, the word British was dropped and it became Commonwealth. Mm-hmm. And everybody accepted it. And the head of the Commonwealth is, you know who?
This tiny little island.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so I think that is so smart because many of them, and especially in the years after the independence, when many of those colonies still continued to do business with the former colonial masters. I mean, you can imagine how much the British economy benefited. Mm-hmm. And literally almost continued the empire. Mm-hmm. After independence, because many of them only wanted to do business with England or right. with Britain, and because that's what they were used to. Mm-hmm. Their infrastructure was created by them, mm-hmm. so they didn't know how to go do shopping in France, or if you were a British colony. You didn't think that you could go to France or go to Spain or go to Russia to do business. You went to Britain.
Yeah.
Fantastic. They are very good at it.
It's amazing now. Yeah. I mean, looking at it now, it's incredible.
And they do it with such gentility such niceness that you really don't understand.
Such beautiful grammar.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Well, I'd like to start by, I'd like for you to tell me something about where you were born, about your family upbringing, including the spiritual aspect of that.
Yeah. Now, I was born in the rural areas of Kenya, in the central highlands. And my community is the Kikuyu. Mm-hmm.
Which is a tribe, or you like to call it a micronation?
I call them micronations because I try to get away from this tribe.
Okay.
Which sometimes has negative connotations. Mm-hmm. And I also like to, by using that word, I try to emphasize that these so-called tribes are actually nations. Mm-hmm. And when you call them tribes, you trivialize their national.
Well, they're cultures,
yeah.
Right?
You could also know them as cultures. Uh-huh. But see, the tribe almost trivializes them to a disorganized group of people who are running around wild in the bush or in the grasslands, half naked, not knowing where they're going or coming from.
It's true.
But the truth of the matter is these were very well-organized and well-structured societies. And they may not have been huge, and they may not have had technological advancement at the rate that the Western civilization had by the time they conquered them. But it was a trivialization that meant that they could have their cultures trampled on and destroyed without regard, because if they are tribes and they are uncivilized, you need to civilize them. Mm-hmm. And to civilize them, you need to destroy whatever little culture there may be, because it's primitive anyway, and give them a more high culture. Now, a very important aspect of any culture is spirituality. And even before you get to dogmas and religion, the spirituality, because every human being has an aspect of spirituality. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I may have inherited without being conscious about it, because my people were already Christians by the time I was growing up, is the fact that my people were very close to nature. And their spirituality reflected in nature in which they lived. And I like to give a story, for example, that reflects that. That when I was a young child, I used to collect firewood. I used to collect firewood for my mother. And I remember my mother telling me not to collect any firewood from this tree called a fig tree, the so-called strangular fig tree. Now, there was a very huge fig tree near our home. And it was very overwhelming. It was the largest tree in the neighborhood. And I asked my mother, why not? Because obviously it was a big tree and branches were falling from this tree all the time. But I had noticed, it's true, that all the branches falling from that tree were never picked. Hmm. So maybe I had picked. I don't remember. I must have picked, or my mother would not have told me, don't pick trees from that fig tree. Don't pick firewood from that fig tree. And when I asked her, why not? She told me, that is a tree of God. Hmm. We don't cut it. We don't burn it. We don't use it. They live for as long as they can, and they fall on their own when they are too old. Now, I didn't think much about that until much, much later. Indeed, when I became environmentally conscious, I remembered that story. I also recognized that in the period of maybe between 1920s to 1960s, a lot of those fig trees, which were numerous in that area because they were never cut, had actually been cut, because having become Christians, the missionaries were very eager to get rid of all these trees that reminded the natives of a God that they did not relate to, because they needed to relate to another God. And this new God was a God who was worshipped in a house called church. But the God they were relating to prior to that was a God that they worshipped under these trees, such as that fig tree. Mm-hmm. Not every one of them, but they definitely were among the sacred trees. You could almost call them secret. I want to put that on inverted commas.
And what did your mother mean? I mean, what was it about the fig tree? Was there more explanation to that about what it was about it that was holy or of God?
Well, it was because that there were a few trees that the people considered sacred. And I'm putting that in inverted commas because mm-hmm. it's not quite what we consider as sacred in the Christian context. But they were holy mm-hmm. trees. They were trees under which they worshipped God.
Okay.
These were trees under which they would offer sacrifices. They believed in offering, burnt offering, like in the Bible, in the Old Testament. They believed in burnt offering of lambs.
Okay.
And they did it under these trees. So these trees were considered, I guess in our context, holy or sacred.
Mm-hmm.
And my mother had already been baptized. But obviously she had one leg in the Christian world and one leg was still in her
traditional. I imagine many people did, though,
yeah,
didn't they?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so, but the point I want to emphasize here is, and what is important in the context of the environment that we are discussing now, is that because they considered these trees of God, without going into the past of how did it all start, why was it this particular tree a tree of God as opposed to the other trees? Why did the people who lived before them come to consider these trees holy? I want to say that these trees, because they are so huge and because they were never cut, they actually provided stabilization of the land because these are highlands.
Mm.
They protected these people from landslides.
Anything physically, they protected people.
Yeah, physically, yeah. They protected
people. There's nothing
people.
Mystical about this.
Yeah, precisely.
Yeah.
They physically protected mm-hmm. the land mm-hmm. from sliding because it's so steep.
Mm-hmm.
And they also, it is said that because they have roots that go very deep, and as I say, because they are not cut, they last forever, they are able to go down into the underground rock. They are able to break the rock, and they are able to bring some of the subterranean water system up nearer to the surface. And so they were responsible for many of the streams that dotted the landscape. So in many ways, therefore, they were part of the water system in the area.
Mm.
And so they served a very important purpose. The minute they were cut, that purpose ended. And of course, nobody quite recognized that. Until now, maybe people are beginning to see, well, where are these trees? Because we do get a lot of landslides now, by the way.
So there's a really pragmatic component to that religious teaching.
Yes, and sometimes in religion, whether it is Christian, Buddhism, or mm-hmm. Judaism, we have these teachings you read in the Bible. The Bible tells you to do this. It doesn't tell you why. But sometimes it's because there is some coded wisdom.
Mm-hmm. Human wisdom, right?
Human wisdom mm-hmm. that people have accumulated in the course of generations.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it becomes a ritual. Sometimes it becomes a cultural practice. Sometimes it's associated with the festival. But when you look into many of these activities that people did before they were influenced by a foreign culture, there was always a very good reason why they did it. It was very much part of their way of having learned how to live within the environment in which they found themselves.
Mm-hmm. So you were very much influenced by this Kikuyu culture and this closeness to nature. But you were raised Catholic, is that correct?
Yes.
And how do you think, I mean, what was the Catholic influence on your thinking about what we now discuss as the environment?
Well, I think that I think that the Catholic has yet to come, I guess. I think that I would say that the Christian faith has not done enough to recognize its role as a custodian of the environment. And that in many ways, Christianity has almost facilitated exploitation of the resources without a conscious effort, such as we are trying to encourage now, mm-hmm. that whatever we do, we must remember that we have a limited amount of resources. Perhaps in those days, and especially as missionaries and explorers and settlers moved into new grounds, perhaps it really did look to them like the resources were unlimited.
Right.
And so there was not the need to think of what we are now trying to advocate, that we realize that we have mm-hmm. a limited amount of resources and that we cannot just continue to consume and consume, because the future generations will not have enough. And we are already beginning to feel the impact of the fact that there is not enough for 6 billion people.
Right.
So we have a lot of people in the world who are deprived, and we are concerned about the fact that in some people in the world are very deprived because we are not sharing these resources equitably. And so we are saying, let us share these resources equitably so that we do not have conflict. But in the past, therefore, I would say that the Christian faith, and I can only talk about the Christian faith because that's my heritage, mm-hmm. Has not really played the role of a custodian, such as now you hear theologians emphasizing.
Right,
that
I think there's an awakening about that within
Absolutely.
Christianity.
Absolutely, I guess that's what we should call it, mm-hmm. is an awakening. Mm-hmm. And it's a good awakening.
But if you think about how you think about the environment, the natural world now, and what you learned growing up in a religious context, you know, what did that teach you?
Well, I don't really think I remember very much of religious teaching of how to take care of the environment. Mm-hmm. I think mostly what what happened to me was just observations of what was happening, perhaps more of the science that I studied biology.
Yes.
And therefore, studying biological systems.
So I'm thinking that you were always interested in the natural world,
yeah.
that you went into biology.
Yeah, maybe that is why I liked biology, because I don't remember being particularly persuaded to study biology. I just did very well. And at that time, teachers tended to push you into the area where you were excelling. Mm-hmm. Now, I was doing very well in biology. I was doing very well in many sciences, but especially in biology. And I guess for my school, which was not very much endowed, it was easier to pursue biology rather than chemistry or physics, because we didn't have the equipment that we needed in order to pursue that, or maybe even the teachers that to take us in that direction. And so I pursued biology. And in fact, my biology teacher in high school became my lifelong friend. She was a nun from Ireland, and she became my lifelong friend, and she died not too long ago. So I think that it was more out of the science and the understanding of the ecological systems and the observations I made in my country, especially the damage that seemed to be happening between the time I left my country in 1960, came to the United States for 5.5 years, then went back. And in that period, my country had become independent. It had introduced new ways of commercial agriculture. Mm. It had introduced cash crops, and these were now growing in the areas where there used to be woodlots, rivers which used to be nice and clean were no longer clean. They were full of silt. So these observations for me aroused an interest that there must be something that is happening that is bad. But it wasn't the faith, and I wish it was, because it should have been. I should have been reading right. the book of Genesis a little more closely.
Right. I'm curious. So clearly there was a huge change in your country between those years that you left and came back. And I think about those years, the early 60s in the United States, it was clearly a really dramatic period here as well. Not a very environmentally conscious period in this culture.
No.
Although the civil rights movement was going on then. Mm. How did that time in the States, how did that flow into the perspective you took back to Kenya?
Yeah. Now, I want to say that sometimes, you know, things happen around in your life and you're not consciously absorbing them, and you're not consciously asking yourself, now, what am I learning out
right.
of all this? But indeed, what you are observing, what you are leading, what you are seeing influences you, sometimes in your subconscious. And I'm quite sure that the civil rights movement in the United States in the 60s greatly influenced my sense of justice, my sense of the need to respect human rights, my sense of respecting the rule of law, which later on became very useful when I accidentally, I would say, became an activist for human rights issues, for women rights issues. And there was no effort for me to do that. And I'm quite sure that if I had not come to America at that time, I would probably not have made human rights issues an issue. It would probably not have struck me
really? That
somebody else's rights were being violated. Yeah, mm-hmm. sometimes, mm-hmm. you know, you take the you are a product of the society in which you grow, and quite often it takes a special kind of mind to break away from the norm, to know or to believe that what everybody is accepting as norm is not right, and to question it, and to almost have people say, what's wrong with you? Everybody else thinks this is all right. Why do you think it's wrong? Mm-hmm. And I think that it is sometimes because you have escaped that society and you have gone to another place and you have seen
your
the alternatives.
Your vision has changed.
Your vision has changed. Up. Your perception mm-hmm. has changed. Mm-hmm. Your consciousness has changed. And so you come and you tell people, now, how can you accept that? And they want to say, what?
Right. Because you suddenly see it.
Yeah, you mm-hmm. suddenly see it, and mm-hmm. and you see it so clearly, so you're passionate about it, and mm-hmm. sometimes people really don't understand what burns you.
And I think, you know, it's so true. As I was reading about the work you're doing, I mean, a tree is a simple thing, right?
Right.
But when you talk about the observations you started to make, in listening initially, it sounds like, in the 70s, to women in Africa, and you started to suddenly see this simple equation between trees and, you know, having to walk far for water and soil erosion and lack of work and lack of fodder for animals and malnutrition. And you kind of wonder how that simple equation had broken apart.
Yeah.
I suppose that's a very common human human paradox. Mm. But
yeah, I think that is so true. One of the things that happens, and this happens to us, whether it is because we are going through a colonial experience like we were, or you're going through an industrial experience like many people would experience in a country like America and other industrialized countries. What happens is that you slowly moved from the world you knew, and you move into another world, and most of the times you move into a world that you believe is better. That's why we are told this is development.
Right, progress.
This is progress, yes. And we accept it. Mm-hmm. And it takes us some time to realize, wait a minute, maybe it was not all good progress. Maybe it was not all positive. Some aspects of it is not quite all right. And you begin to see how things have become disconnected. And now the challenge is to see, how can you connect them again? How can you make people see the linkages?
Mm-hmm. That, in fact, are organic.
Yeah.
Right.
And that's really the challenge. And mm-hmm. When I was looking at, for example, when I was listening to the women in 1975.
Okay, so let's set the scene. You are a professor of
I was
biology.
Teaching in the University of Nairobi. Mm-hmm. I wasn't actually even teaching biology.
And you were the
first woman
with a PhD in Central Africa.
Yeah.
Which is amazing.
Yeah, but that was in the 70s.
Okay.
But in the 60s, in the mid-60s, when I go back home, I joined the University of Nairobi as an assistant lecturer in the Faculty of Veterinary Medicine. And it's very interesting how I go into the School of Veterinary Medicine because I'm not a vet. And people are shocked when I say that because a lot of people think I'm a vet.
Right. You're a biologist. I know it's
a
veterinary anatomy is the
phrase
I saw.
See, what happens is it's a whole story, so we don't have all day. In a nutshell.
Yeah.
What happened was that when I went back, I couldn't find a job in the School of Sciences, mm-hmm. Biological Sciences. But I had something I had done something in the University of Pittsburgh with a wonderful professor, Charles Laff, a wonderful man who really guided me during my master's program in the School of Biological Sciences in the University of Pittsburgh. And that man, he was working on the Japanese quails. And he was looking at a gland called the pineal gland, mm-hmm. pineal gland, which is, for those of you who are anatomists, which, as you know, is immediately it's not connected, but it's very close to the pituitary gland. Let's get out of the anatomy.
All right.
And say that it's a small gland that is very underdeveloped in the higher animals, including humans. But it becomes very developed in birds. So my good professor, Charles Laff, wanted to know, how does this gland develop in birds? And can we observe anatomical differences as the bird develops from the early days past adult? And so you'd be surprised. I cut through so many brains of Japanese quails to look at this gland at different stages of development. Mm. And so I needed to process the tissues and all that. And now that technique, and I did want to say that because so many times as graduate students, as college students, we do things that we think are very relevant because what we want to do is to come up with the results and write a thesis and get a degree. But for me, it was that technique that I was using to process the tissues that eventually got me a job in the University of Nairobi. Because I got to the university and nobody else knew how to process them tissues. So they said, who knows how to process tissues so that you can look at them under the microscope? I said, I do. And that's how I got a job in the School of Veterinary Medicine in a department that was led by a professor, Rainer Hofmann, a German professor who was working in the University of Nairobi, who also became a wonderful friend of mine to this day. And he guided me so well and eventually had me go to Germany and spend some time in Germany. But because of spending over almost 15 years teaching in the School of Veterinary Medicine in the Department of Anatomy, many of my friends thought I was a vet, so I always make a joke that they used to say, well, we are slaughtering a goat and we need a vet, so come over. I said, I do it at your own risk. And friends would call me when their cats and dogs are sick, and I say, listen, I know nothing about what happens to them cats and dogs.
So, all right, so how did you start planting trees?
Well, in the University of Nairobi, there were very few women. There were actually originally two of us and then three. Mm-hmm. And we were being very badly treated because the university had never dealt with women academic members of staff, so they didn't have terms of service. But one thing they knew is that we should not enjoy the same terms of service as men. But they didn't know how to draft our terms of service. But before they got there, we were complaining like mad that we should not be discriminated against. And as part of this campaign, I joined the National Council of Women to represent the Association of University Women. And the National Council of Women was an umbrella organization for all the women organizations. Now, you remember in 1975, the first United Nations Women Conference was called in Mexico, and women in the world were preparing. And so in Kenya, we started preparing. Hmm. And I found myself in a forum where Kenyan women were discussing the agenda that we should take to Mexico. And I came in, I had my own agenda about the discrimination of women in
universities.
The University of Nairobi. Yes. But when I got there, then I listened to what the rural women were talking about. And it was the rural women's story that actually struck me. And I completely forgot my story. Mm. Because for me, by comparison, I was complaining about minutiae. By comparison to what these women were really asking for. They were asking for water. They were asking for food, nutritious food. They were asking for energy, which was mainly firewood. And they were saying they have no income. And when I listened to what they were saying, it so happened that many of these women also came from the highlands, the same highlands where, in the same highlands where I grew up. And it struck me that in that period of less than 10 years, so much change had taken place in the environment, that water was no longer clean. Yet when I was a child, I would go to the river and I fetch water for my mother. We would come home, we would drink it, we didn't even boil it. And there was no firewood, and as a child, I was collecting firewood for my mother in the woodlots. But all these woodlots had been cleared to make way for tea and coffee. And because of the new commercial agriculture and because of clearing the bushes, now there was massive soil erosion and leaching of agrochemicals into the water, so the water was no longer clean. And that's why in my acceptance speech, I talked about the fact that... for the Nobel Prize. You remember I mentioned the fact that I was shocked by the fact that the stream where I used to play as a child with the tadpoles dried up.
Right.
And the fig tree that my mother had talked about had been cut to make way for tea. And these changes really struck me. But as I always say, it wasn't a miracle. A biologist and an observing scientist can quickly see things are not moving in the right direction. And so I told the women, now you know what I think? We should plant trees. And it was really just...
You started with 7 trees, is that right?
I planted 7 trees. Yeah. 5 died, 2 survived.
In downtown Nairobi.
Uh-huh. And the 2 are still alive, which is fantastic. But the important thing for me was to see the linkage. And that's what I try to encourage people to do. If you're going to do anything for the environment, you have to see what has been disconnected.
It really strikes me that how important it was, that proximity that you had to that land, and also that you saw what a short period of time it had taken for such destruction to happen.
Yes.
But maybe that also empowered you to think that taking some simple steps could, as you say, you know, reconnect what had been disconnected.
Yes, because I immediately could see that if you planted trees, you'd protect the soil from soil erosion, you'd provide the firewood for the women. If they planted fruit trees, they can supplement their diets. The trees grow very fast, so they can easily sell these trees and make an income. So I quickly saw how the tree could solve the problem.
I think that part of your story is so important, because when people are presented, I think especially with these great ecological disasters or impending disasters,
it's
the same thing with political problems. Mm. It seems so enormous.
Right.
That an individual person wonders what they could possibly do. But, I mean, your story is actually one of looking at what you knew, what you were close to, and seeing what had gone wrong and seeing in a very basic way what you could do to move it back.
Absolutely.
Right.
And I really think that that's part of what the Norwegian Nobel Committee saw was the simplicity but also the complexity. The fact that this here's something that is being done by individuals at the grassroots level, but it also gradually had the capacity to get to the decision makers and make the decision makers sit up, either to stop you or to control you, because they felt like you were threatening them. And
that 2 trees that live can become 30 million trees, which is pretty remarkable.
Yeah, indeed, because of the mobilization. Mm-hmm. But I would say, since we are talking about the faith, that to a very large extent, I want to say that if I had perhaps not gone to school in a Catholic school, in a school that was managed by sisters, by nuns, at a time when missionaries were really very serious about values, they were very concerned about values, and especially the value of service, I think I would probably have turned out to be a different kind of a person. Because for me, as I said earlier, sometimes people don't have to tell you this is what you need to believe in, and this is the value you need to embrace. You just observe. And when people ask me, who are the people who inspired you? These are some of the people who actually inspired me, these nuns. Mm-hmm. That these, at the time, beautiful women, young women. And I remember thinking, now, why did they leave their country to come here? Mm. Why didn't they get married and have families? Why did they decide to come? Mm. And, of course, the answer was because they wanted to serve Jesus. They are the brides of Jesus. They even wore rings because they told us they were married spiritually to Jesus. Right. And I think that that sense of service beyond self, because I really couldn't see, and even today when you look at it, what do they have? What is the benefit? We are so used to doing things because we benefit. There is something. Mm-hmm. We always want to know, why are you doing that? Because there must be something you're going to get. When you look at nuns like that, what do they get out of that?
And isn't that an interesting way also to think about, you and I were talking earlier about how the Christian church in general, Christian theology, has really not paid attention to the environment.
Yeah.
In fact, has interpreted some of the stories and teachings that are in there in a way that's been destructive to the environment. And there's people are waking up to that. But that's an interesting way to think about how even traditions which have something to correct can look to other virtues, right?
Yes.
And besides just the teaching on the environment, this virtue of service that is there and that has been very strong.
Mm. And that virtue is really what we are calling upon to take care of the environment, because we are saying we want to protect the environment, not so that we can use it, not for our own purpose. We want to protect biodiversity, not so that we can use these forms of life, because some of them we don't even know they're there. But for the fact that they are for their own good, I'm looking for another way to put it, to say that, for whatever it's worth, there is another concept if I think about it. But it is to say that you're not doing it because of something beneficial that you are going to get, something tangible. And that's a very important experience, especially today, because I find, even in my own country, I find that every time you want to tell people, do this, it is good to do it, people want to say, what do I get out of it? Mm-hmm. It's like you can't give something unless you are going to get something. Now, of course, for the nuns, they will tell you, I'll go to heaven. Well, okay, fine. But
it's a real long-term goal.
It's a long-term goal. Yeah. And we are still here on earth. And the fact that they are that committed. And even some of these people who tell me, what am I going to get out of it? They'll tell me very loudly that they want to go to heaven.
I actually wanted to ask you about, let's say, those first women who you had this conversation with, you paid attention to what their needs were, and then you planted these trees. I wanted to know, you know, what effect that had on them, on these women in their lives.
Yeah, one of those women, actually, that I like to remember was a woman called Priscilla Mereka. And Priscilla eventually became a member she came from the Presbyterian women.
Mm. Is she rural resident also?
Yeah, she was a Kenyan.
Yeah.
She was from the Presbyterian Church of East Africa, and she was representing the Women's Guild in the National Council of Women. So she's one of those women who listened, who were presenting. And later on, when I said, why don't we plant trees? And we formed a small committee within the National Council of Women. She became a member of that committee. And we worked together for many years. Unfortunately, she died some years ago, maybe about 10 years ago now. But she, by the time she died, she had completely transformed her landscape so very much that when she, when they were putting her remains to rest, everybody in the community was praising her, not only for the work that she had done in the church, but the fact that she had brought the Greenbelt movement in her area, that she had facilitated and encouraged the planting of literally millions of trees. And that one thing that I remember women saying is that, you know how in, you always see these women carrying their firewood on their back, mm-hmm. and there is a typical rope that they use, usually made out of animal hide. And the women said at her funeral that you never see any woman today with that rope because it's not necessary. No woman need carry firewood because the firewood is at the household. Hmm. And that I thought was such a legacy for her.
Hmm. You know, the word sustainability is everywhere now. And it's a wonderful word. I would really love to hear what your definition is of sustainability. I'd like to hear it in your your voice and in your vocabulary.
Well, I can assure you that there are very many people who don't know what that word really
means.
No,
that's
means.
Right, and that's yeah. So how and, would you
and
how
different
would you
people
dis-
have
define
different,
it?
Yes. explanations, but for me, the way I understand it is that you're using resources in a way that you ensure that you can use those resources for a long time. So you can sustain yourself, even if you take that word literally, you can sustain yourself with those resources for a very long time. Now, take beyond yourself and say your nation, your region, globally, we can sustain ourselves for a very long time. Now, a long time means not only our generation, but the future generations. And the future generations can be between here and eternity, because when do we know how long this planet is going to last? Mm. And so we want to believe that 100 million years from now, I don't know whether the planet will still be here, but we want to appreciate that until perhaps, I guess, the Americans find another planet. It seems like we are very close to finding another planet where there might be life and we can move on. Yeah. But until then, this is the only planet we know where there is life, where we can live. And therefore, we need to do whatever it takes to ensure that we do not eliminate ourselves from this planet by exploiting the resources that we need. Because, for example, we know that we cannot live on this planet if we don't have green life, because green life is the only life that is able to trap the sun energy and give us food and give us firewood and give us timber and give us fodder and give us and clean the air we breathe. Mm. So we know, therefore, that we must maintain the green life on this planet, and that if we were to desertify this land, this planet, and remove every green vegetation, we would be dead before the last tree dies.
Mm. So it is a matter of life and death.
It is a matter of life and death, mm-hmm. absolutely.
And I think in Africa, you know that. I mean, you talk about conflict, how it's not just life that's threatened. It's not just whether people can eat. It's peace itself that is threatened by a scarcity of resources. I think that in the United States, there's been a period of time, you know, as you said, those British colonists, when they first came to Africa, it was unlimited resources.
Yes.
And I think Americans have had what we now recognize as a false sense of unlimited resources. You know, they were either here or we could buy them.
Right.
I mean, this is simplified, but right. And yet, I think with so many things that are happening in the world, with the fact that many of these resources are, in fact, running out, with climate change, I think people here are coming back to a sense that you've had all along, that this is not just about life and death. It's also the difference between peace and war.
Absolutely. And even that peace is almost like life and death, because when we do not have peace, we could easily get into a conflict and a war. And of course, when we are there, we kill each other. So mm-hmm. it's a matter of life and death indeed. But it is extremely important, and especially for people who live in highly industrialized and rich countries, because people who live in such countries have a feeling that even if they don't have resources within their borders, they can get them mm-hmm. from wherever those resources are.
Yeah.
And this message is very, very important to these people, because it is important to know that even if you can buy those resources, even there is a limit to what extent you can get those resources and not create a conflict. Because remember, all the resources, you get the resources, but the resources that are left behind, people have to fight over them.
Right.
And because the world is now so interconnected, it is, and I know that the Americans probably know this more than any other person, that when conflict are anywhere in the world, sometimes they come right into your living room, mm-hmm. either through television or like now with the Americans being a superpower, a very influential member of the United Nations. If there is conflict somewhere, we are very quick to say we need peacekeeping forces. And these peacekeeping forces are quite often soldiers from areas where there is peace.
Right.
So suddenly you realize you may be in peace, but mm-hmm. it is your son or your husband who now has to go and try to keep peace where peace has been threatened. Mm-hmm. And so it becomes really an important issue for all of us, whether we are rich or we are poor. And it is important, especially for, as I say, for industrialized countries. Recently, I was in Japan, and I want to share that when I went to Japan, I was very lucky because I came across a word called Motainai. And I explained that I was talking to a news editor of a newspaper called Mainichi. And we started talking about the need for reducing how much resources we use, reusing what we can, recycling what we can. And he told me about this word Motainai, which is a Japanese Buddhist concept that is entrenched in the Japanese culture, which encourages people not to waste resources. Mm. And this was especially true, they
and
told
it's
me.
It's a spiritual concept.
Yeah, it's a spiritual concept. Mm-hmm. In fact, this aspect was brought to me, was brought out to me by a monk. I think his name is Monk Mori from Kyoto Temple. We went in and he had heard me use that word publicly, and he said, I'm so happy you're using that word Motainai, because it is a word that Japanese don't use anymore, because they feel embarrassed to say don't waste resources because they have so much. Mm. Or receive resources with gratitude. Receive what you get from the Mother Earth with gratitude, or from nature with gratitude. And we usually don't think about that. We don't usually thank nature for giving us what she does.
All right.
And it reminded me of the Christian concept of let us be custodians of the environment, of the resources, rather than of
stewardship.
The stewardship thing. Mm-hmm. And I'm very happy that theologians now are really more and more encouraging us to think of ourselves as custodians, mm-hmm. stewards, mm-hmm. rather than domineering masters. Mm-hmm. So this coming from a country like Japan is very
interesting.
It's very interesting, yes. And it's very, very good. And I was very happy that because it was their word, when I started using it, they said, oh, this is so wonderful. I said, yeah. And especially because in the industrialized countries like America, you have the technology, you have the capital, you have the skills. You can actually use a lot of resources that instead of wasting them, you can recycle them, mm-hmm. using the technology. And you can therefore help to save how much of the resources that are being used in the world. But see, if you become wasteful, if you are not grateful, if you don't recycle, because why should you recycle when you can buy more? You must always remember, but there are billions out there who don't have enough even to survive, let alone to decide whether they should reduce or reuse.
It's hard for people to, for those billions to seem real, you know, to influence little tiny decisions that are made in the course of daily life about whether to recycle something.
Precisely. I know that they look distant because quite often we don't see their faces except when they are dying and their faces are brought to the television in our living rooms. And then we are very quick to call our representatives and tell them, do something about these people who are dying in this corner of the world. But it's happening all the time.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you, so much of your work has been with women. And you write a lot about the balance of power between men and women. And I wanted to ask if you think of that, the balance of power between men and women, also as a sustainability issue.
Well, I do. The truth of the matter is we are all resources anyway. A resource. We are a human resource.
Okay.
And the biggest problem that we have had, especially in the women movement, is trying to convince the other half that we are a very important resource and that we can, and we do make great contributions, and therefore we should be respected. Talk of the word respect. We should be respected. We should be appreciated. Our work should be quantified. We should be compensated, and that we should not be taken for granted. Now, that's, unfortunately, 30 years ago in 1975, when I, as I said earlier, when we were meeting to go to Mexico, we were going there because we wanted to...
For the United Nations Women's Conference.
Women's Conference, the very first one. And that, it was at that conference that we declared the Women Decade. Well, it's 35, almost 36 years later. And we're still talking about it. Obviously, we have made great strides. And we should be very, very proud of what the strides we have made. But it is true that women are still a very unappreciated resource in many societies. I'm in the Kenya government at the moment, and I can see how quickly women, who even very competent women, are sacrificed on the altar of political convenience.
That's a strong sentence.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you, over these years, you, it's not all been happy ceremonies planting trees. I mean, you've been scorned and you've been pursued and you've been beaten. You've stood up to powerful forces. And I wanted to ask you, you know, you didn't know when all this started that it would become so large, that you would found this great movement, that you would win the Nobel Peace Prize. I mean, but what kept you going? What were the resources you drew on in the hardest times?
Yeah. Now, again, I would probably say that that is where the experience and the being molded by people of faith made a lot of difference. That although I was not professing my faith, I'm quite sure that I was grounded in that moral fiber of wanting to do the right thing, of wanting to pursue the right thing. And I'm, as I we said earlier, this I'm quite sure is part of the heritage that I brought with me from Atchison, Kansas. Tiny little Atchison, Kansas is very
powerful.
That's
where you went to college. The small Benedictine College.
The Benedictine College. And, yes. And I spent 4 years there, most wonderful years with the Benedictine sisters and fathers. And I know that deep inside me, that moral fiber that was molded by those religious leaders really helped me pursue what I believed was the right. I was so sure that this was the right thing because I could see it was quite obvious. And even those who were persecuting me knew, and I knew they knew, but they did not want to
knew that you
me,
were doing the right thing?
Yeah, they knew I was doing the right thing.
Okay.
But they didn't want me to do it because it was inconveniencing them. And I knew that. But I felt that it is not right. And I say that's the heritage I brought with me from America. That pursuing the fact that people have a right to clean drinking water. So anybody who is really polluting that water knows he's doing the wrong thing or knows he should not do. Mm-hmm. Anybody who is interfering with the catchment areas where these rivers come from so that some rivers start drying up. He knows he's doing the wrong thing. And because he's doing it to enrich himself, and he's enriching himself with resources that have been entrusted to him by the public, and he knows the public don't know. And if they know, they are too afraid to challenge him. So me, when I challenge, he can afford to intimidate, he can afford to ridicule, because I'm alone. But I had that conviction that I'm right, and he knows it.
Now, I think there's something really interesting in that, that you didn't, it sounds to me like you always assumed that there was a morality, a conscience somewhere, even inside the people who were, or an ability to see what you saw about what was right.
It was too obvious for people not to see.
Yeah, but it would also have been possible for you to just write these people off, to fight them, to declare them evil. Do you know what I'm saying?
But I didn't have the power to do anything to them.
Right.
They had the power.
Uh-huh.
That's why they could arrest me. They could take me to jail. They could ridicule me publicly. They had the power. I didn't have the power. I couldn't do anything. So the only thing I had, the option I had, was to work with these ordinary people and try to teach them. Initially, I didn't do any teaching. But gradually, when I saw that people were being taken advantage of because they were ignorant, mm-hmm. I started reading the Bible, you know, the book of Hosea. The book of
you're reading the prophets.
Yeah, the prophet. I wanted to know, what did the prophets do when these things happened? And I read about the books of Hosea. Sometimes it's fascinating to read about these old Bible stories and see. And sometimes the stories you read, they are almost replicated in the world we live in. So I read, for example, the book of Hosea quite often. And I think it is chapter 4. And it talks about this prophet who is sent to the people of Israel to tell them they will perish because they are so ignorant.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, you are ignorant, and even the priests are ignorant, and you are not listening to the instructions of the Lord, and so you will perish. So I saw literally that our people were perishing because they were ignorant. They didn't understand the linkages between the problems they were facing and the environmental degradation that was happening right there below their feet.
That's an interesting. It's an interesting model too, because it is that what the prophets were doing, what you were doing in a sense, is railing against your own people on for their sake.
Yeah,
right? For the sake of their everlasting souls.
Yeah.
Kind of.
Telling them that, you know, open your eyes and see that what we are doing is very, very important. And don't be intimidated. Don't be persuaded by these people who are in power, because whatever they are doing it against your good and the good of your children. So at least plant trees, for goodness sake. And by planting trees, you're not harming anybody. You're not harming them.
Right, right.
But I knew that they didn't like what I was doing.
It's kind of an ecological form of civil disobedience.
It
really,
was,
planting
in fact.
Trees.
It was indeed. And indeed, it became a symbol, and it became a symbol of our defiance. Every time, for example, we wanted to protect a forest that the people in power were privatizing. For example, I remember we had a big fight over a forest called Karura, which is close to the... It is actually within Nairobi, and it is actually essentially the lung of Nairobi, the equivalent of Central Park in New York.
Okay.
And they wanted to clear cut this forest and put up residential houses. And I said, are you out of your mind? You need this forest. And they said, we don't need the forest. We need houses. Now, you tell me. So we would defiantly now take trees and march with our seedlings towards the forest and say, we are marching to go and plant trees. Now, ordinarily, nobody should be bothered about a bunch of women trying to plant a tree. But because we were marching towards this forest, we were essentially saying, you are not going to clear cut this forest. You are not going to put any residential houses in this forest, because this forest is needed by the city.
Mm. And did you win that battle?
After many years,
okay.
We won,
okay.
Which is great. And that little forest is still there, Thank God.
Well, tell me this. I mean, you are now in a government position. Is there any way in which being in a position of power and seeing the challenge of having to think about the common good and from that perspective, does that complicate your understanding of how change happens? Or
now, I am in the government, but I can symbolically say that I'm right at the door.
Okay.
I'm right at the door. I'm not right inside. and therefore, I haven't actually experienced the conflicts that people get when they are in power and are challenged to do things for the common good rather than for themselves. And it's very interesting because this government was put in power in the year 2002.
The current Kenyan government.
The current Kenyan government was actually a very popular government. It was put there after many years of struggle. We finally...
Right, after dictatorship, essentially.
Yes, we removed the dictator, we changed, and we promised people we were going to be a very clean government. And we declared that we were going to have zero tolerance, especially to corruption. And so it has come as a big surprise that some of us have actually been found being so blatantly corrupt. And although...
You mean some of the people in the current government?
In the current government. And as you know, we have lost some ministers. They have not yet been tried, and so we can't say that they are corrupt until, of course, they have been tried and they have been convicted. But the fact that the people who have been charged with the responsibility of curbing corruption have come up with accusations that we in the government are corrupt. That has been extremely painful and very devastating to some of us because we got in there to clean the house.
Mm-hmm.
But if you are outside or at the door, you don't know what's happening inside the door, and sometimes you can get very frustrated because you are part of the government, and therefore whatever is happening, you are part and parcel. And we have this policy and culture of collective responsibility. But we are, I think that there are people who are committed to good governance and who will do everything to promote good governance. But I also want to say that in any society, it is very important that you have strong systems that will ensure that there are checks and balances to protect those in leadership from the great temptations that I'm sure they are confronted with once they are in those positions of power.
I think it's really interesting that after this huge grassroots movement that you started, which in many ways remains grassroots, you also have come to emphasize the importance of what you call democratic space.
Yes.
And as you say, systems of checks and balance,
balances,
pragmatic political structures.
Yes. Yes, very, very important. Because what I have seen, it was a progression. I started with a simple activity of planting trees. And I thought, of course, nobody would be bothered about planting trees until I realized that people in power don't like to see ordinary people organizing, especially if those people in power they do not have that belief in democratic space.
Mm-hmm.
They want control. That's why you don't want democratic space, because you want to control people.
Okay.
And so the minute I started organizing people into groups and teaching them why we must protect the environment, and of course eventually discovering that some of the corporates are the people in power. And so we would say it is very important to have checks and balances so that even the people in power are not able to destroy the environment. Because if they are left alone, they will destroy, like they were trying to privatize that little forest we were talking about in Nairobi. So the minute we started discussing not only the symptoms that we were trying to address, but the causes of those symptoms, we got into trouble with the government because the government didn't like us addressing the causes because they were part of it.
Right.
So it became very clear to me that you cannot manage the resources sustainably.
Okay, we're back at sustainability.
We are back there.
Yes, yes.
You cannot do it sustainably, and you cannot share the resources equitably, either at the national level, regional, or even global level, if you don't have systems of governance that facilitate that.
Okay.
And that brings us to the point where the Norwegian Nobel Committee recognized that in order for us to live more in peace in the future, and especially with the resources being so limited and with the population rise still continuing, it is very important for us as a human family to recognize the need for us to manage the resources we have sustainably, share them equitably. But we can all understand and appreciate that we can raise, that's what I was talking about when I said, we must raise the level of consciousness to get to the point where we appreciate that you can't do so if you don't have the right systems of governance, and therefore deliberately preempt potential conflict.
Okay. I see you getting restless. Are we out of time?
Okay.
Great. All right. Okay. I just wanted to work. Let me just look at my notes to see. There's so much we could talk about. Let's see. What?
She's getting some more water.
Okay, good. Okay. All right. All right. I'll go ahead and just ask you this. I wonder sometimes there's so much attention suddenly to Africa. There's the G8. There's the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. There's Bono. Right? I've wondered how all this attention feels for someone who's in Africa, who's been working on these, on all kinds of local issues and regional and national issues for a long time.
One thing I would say is that, unfortunately, the press...
There's a lot of hype around it.
Yeah. The attention sometimes to the African continent is often in relation to tragedy that has hit.
Yes.
And
or terrible diseases
that are raging.
Yes.
And quite often people tend to almost pretend that they didn't know what was happening there. So suddenly there has been this eruption like a volcano. But these things are happening all the time. You're dealing with them all the time for 30 years. Mm-hmm. I was saying the environment is very important. Let us focus on it. But believe me, there are very few people who want to give you money to take care of the environment. They'll give you money to buy drugs. They'll give you money to buy guns. They'll give you money to do other things. But when it comes to taking care of the environment, that can wait.
Okay.
And yet we know that the hunger that eventually has the face of that starving, emaciated woman or man or child on television, that didn't happen yesterday. Mm-hmm. It has been happening for a very long time.
And that's related to the environment.
And it's related to the environmental management.
Right, it's related to the environment at the source rather than just feeding people once they're hungry.
Yes,
yes.
And it's also related to governance. And I remember it's only recently, very, very recently, especially since the fall of the Berlin Wall, that we started seeing our leaders in Africa being told by their partners in the developed countries to practice good governance. Excuse me, problems in Africa didn't start after the Berlin Wall fell.
Right.
They have been there.
Right.
But especially since independence and up to that point, we have been dealing with very dictatorial governments, very destructive governments, governments who did not respect the human rights, they violated their people, they facilitated the exploitation of their people, they looted the treasury, and much of that money was actually hidden in banks in the Western countries. Mm-hmm. They accumulated debts, and much of that money never reached the people. And as you know, we have been campaigning for a long time to have these debts cancelled. And it hasn't happened, although I must give credit to G8 and people like right. Bono. They're working very hard right now yeah. and trying to address that issue. But unfortunately, people who are on the ground like us, you can talk all day. You are not headline. But fortunately, when Bono talks and he says that he can't believe what he sees in Africa when he comes, then the press pays attention. Mm-hmm. So I want to thank Bono and all those very important, especially personalities, celebrities, who put their names against these problems and who draw attention to the world. But it is not because the world doesn't know that these problems are there. They know, but they ignore them. But unfortunately, it takes people like Bono, people like Gadoff, for some of these leaders even to begin to think that, yeah, now, since these people have spoken. And so I'm very, very happy that we have these celebrities who actually come out and raise these issues and make it possible for governments that can do something. But it's always very, very difficult. One of the biggest problems we have, even with a program such as the Green Belt Movement, is how to raise money. Mm-hmm. And to raise enough money, not only to respond to the activities in Kenya, but to respond to the activities in the whole region.
Right.
I have been giving an example of just to give people an idea of the environmental challenge that we have in Africa. I mentioned the Congo forest ecosystem. I want to mention the fact that when the Commander Collins and her colleagues went to the space recently with the Shuttle Discovery.
Yes.
They had a very interesting experience on their way back. They said that they saw a thick blanket of dust over Africa. And that dust was due to deforestation. Hmm. It was due to devegetation. It was due to cultivation of land, literally removing vegetation from the land and exposing the soil.
Okay.
Now, the challenge for the African people is to plant those trees.
Right.
Now, I am trying to tell
that's
people,
what you're doing.
Plant trees.
Okay.
But I think I need Bono.
Okay. to say plant
to come
trees.
And say, help Wangari plant trees.
All right.
And so then I might get the money.
I'm really glad I gave you a chance to say that on the radio. I want to ask you one more question. We started at talking about growing up and within your culture, trees were holy places or they created holy places. And you had a Catholic upbringing. I mean, you read the prophet Hosea when you were fighting some of your darkest battles. I want to ask you about your image of God. How do you think about that's a hard. I don't usually ask people a direct question like that,
yeah.
But I'd be really curious about your response to what is your work with trees? I mean, all the work you've done, the battles you've fought, and you know, even your new awareness of the importance of democratic spaces. I mean, how does all of that flow into your understanding of?
Yeah, well,
these big religious questions.
Yeah. Well, you know, as you know, I'm not a theologian, so I would shock the theologians about my concept of God. But when I was in a Catholic school in Nyeri, which is when I was doing my primary education, I was actually in the being taught by sisters of the Consolata Order of the Consolata. Who come from Milan, by the way, and their founder recently became beatified, by the way, so they are on the right track.
Yeah.
And at that time, I must say that religion was extremely superficial in the way that God was presented to us.
Mm-hmm.
Because God was presented to us in the way he appears in the Sistine Chapel.
Okay.
You know, by Michael Ajero. So at that time, it was, I would say, a very superficial presentation of God, almost like a human person. And with the mind of a young person, you almost felt like, yeah, God is somewhere in Rome or somewhere in the sky, in the clouds. And then, of course, you remember my own background, and I was already removed from my own background because my parents had already converted into Christianity.
Mm-hmm. from Kikuyu culture.
Yes, mm-hmm. but there was always that influence of, for example, the fact that they believed that God lived on Mount Kenya.
Yes.
And they had a great reverence to Mount Kenya. And so in the course of my environmentalism, I have often visited those two concepts of the way my ancestors presented God to me and the missionaries presented God
to
me.
So the Sistine Chapel or Mount Kenya.
Yeah. Now where is God? And I tell myself, of course, now we are in a completely new era when we are learning to fight God, not in a place, but rather in ourselves, in each other, in nature. That God is you know, in many ways it's a contradiction because the church teaches you that God is omnipresent.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if he is omnipresent, he's in Rome, but he can also be in Kenya at the same time if he is omnipresent. So I have had this transformation for me of who God is. I still believe strongly that there is that power, his shape, his size, his color. I have no idea. But you are influenced by what you hear, what you see. But I still, when I look on Mount Kenya, it is so magnificent. It is so overpowering. It is so important to in sustaining life in my area that sometimes I say, yes, God is on this mountain. And I don't have a contradiction. But I don't pretend that I know where God, as the theologians would have us, is. But I want to say that God is in me. God is in you. God is in the trees. God is everywhere. If God is everywhere, if that concept of omnipresent is true, then God is everywhere. He doesn't have shape. He doesn't have size. He doesn't have color. So we ought to see God in every one of us. And if we did see God that way, we would have a different idea of how we should relate to each other and to the other species.
Thank you so much, Wangari Maathai.
Most welcome.
I actually believe we're all theologians, so.
Well, that's it. Yeah. Well, maybe that's it. Yeah. We are all theologians.
Now, did I say that correctly? Wangari Maathai.
Yeah, perfect.
All right.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Most welcome.
What an honor. What? Oh, you know, we...
I would have to ask them. I would ask which, because we do sing sometimes, but those are very local songs. Like one song that I always sing when we are together with the women, "Here Comes My Faith," is that because there is a lot of our people are still very religious. And so quite often when I'm talking to them, I use religious songs. And one song that we always sing is, is one that says there is no other God. There is no other God but Him, and there is no other power but Him.
It's a hymn.
It's like a chorus.
Okay.
Yeah. So you want me to sing for you?
Yeah,
yeah, I can.
Yeah.
Well, give me hot water. Open the.
You know, I don't know that it's heated up. Actually,
no,
it's cold. Is the coffee hot?
Yeah.
It's bad. I warned you. Mm. Bad coffee, but.
Oh, are you going to have coffee?
Well, I don't usually take coffee,
I'll
so.
I'll see how
it doesn't. It's so weak. It doesn't have caffeine.
Is that so?
Do you want anything with it, or just plain?
Just plain.
Okay.
Just to keep my. And this kind of song would be very appropriate because when we are singing, when we are moving, we always wanted to be peaceful, non-violent. So singing religious songs was a very common thing.
Okay.
We go.
Yeah.
Hakuna. Mungu kama yeye hakuna, kama yeye hakuna, Mungu kama yeye hakuna, Mungu kama yeye hakuna, upendo kama wake hakuna, kama wake hakuna, upendo kama wake hakuna, upendo kama wake hakuna, nguvu kama zake hakuna, kama zake hakuna, nguvu kama zake hakuna, nguvu kama zake.
Thank you. It's beautiful. Is that this? Did you say the title is, or the? Is that the God is? There's one God. No.
It says there is no God like Him. There is no God like Him. And it's just a chorus, yeah. Mm-hmm. So, and then you say, there is no God like Him. There is no life, love like His. There isn't. There is no love like His. And there is no strength like His. No strength like His.
Thank you.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. That's really good.
To write the words.
No, just is it?
Is there a title?
Is there a name of it? The song.
Even in
Hakuna Mungu. Hakuna.
Yeah.
This is in Kiswahili. Because I can also sing it in another language. There is no God.
And that's the same song?
Yeah. Okay. The Hakuna Mungu means there is no God.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Or did you want me to write the whole thing?
No, this is fine.
Yeah. Hakuna Mungu, there is no God.
That's perfect.
In Swahili.
All right.
Can I take a picture of you and Krista?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Mitch, can you move and trade places with Mitch so I don't get the picture in the background? Yeah.
Okay.
How about the holiday and garbage can?
Yeah. Well, I just don't want the picture on the wall.
It's such an honor to have this time with you. Thank you so much.
Okay.
Oops.
1, 2, 3.
Okay, can I
get one of you alone?
Okay.
Should we?
photogenic woman in the world.
What?
Especially because of the most photogenic woman.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Ellen.
Oh, sure. Thank you for being so patient with our time this morning. Sorry we were late. We were very glad to have it. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Good luck with your traveling.
I hope the rest of this trip doesn't wear you out.
Well, if I keep singing, I'll be all right.
Yeah. Emily, now you know the trick. That's her to sing. No.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
We also want to interview Bono, so if we get him.
Yeah.
Oh, great.
Let's help him.
Damn, I didn't mind it for the tree.
Thank you so much. What a pleasure.
Okay.
All right.
Bye-bye. Travel safely.
Thank you. Bye-bye.